So we've heard about the cuts to K-12 education and about how people are trying to rise above them. But what about the roots of the budget crisis? What are the policies that have forced schools to make such difficult cutbacks to education? To get some perspective, Making Contact producer Andrew Stelzer spoke with an editor at the magazine Rethinking Schools.
Joining us now is Stan Karp. He's an editor of the magazine Rethinking Schools. And Stan recently wrote an article for the magazine titled School Reform We Can't Believe In. Stan, welcome to Making Contact.
Thank you.
So right now, we have tens of thousands of teachers being laid off, class sizes increasing, schools are being closed. Is this simply about a lack of money, or is there a structural problem that's enabled this really dismal reality?
Well, actually, probably a combination of both. Underfunding of public education is an endemic problem. There was a famous court case back in the early 70s that took the issue of educational inequality to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said while there was certainly a lot of inequality, it was not a federal issue because education is not mentioned in the U.S. Constitution, and it became a state-by-state issue as to how the 50 states were going to fund public education. And in most states, the systems are very inadequate to the needs of public school children and the needs of what kind of resources are necessary to deliver quality education. And there's also a lot of inequities so that we not only don't provide enough resources to all schools, but we provide better resources to some kids than others. And the current economic crisis is simply exacerbated that. As a matter of fact, if it wasn't for last year's stimulus bill, several hundred thousand teachers would have lost their jobs last year. And now we're coming around to the same kind of budget situation without federal stimulus funds. And so the chickens are coming home to roost in a very, you know, serious way.
What about President Obama's Race to the Top program? Right now, states are competing for federal money for schools. Do you think this is the answer, or even part of the answer, to the budget crisis?
No, it's no answer to any of our problems in public education. One of the things that has happened is that the Obama administration has actually built on the test, punish, and privatize approach of the Bush era to kind of continue policies in this direction. For example, all the new money that the federal government wants to give to education this year, in Race to the Top and related programs, it wants to distribute as competitive grants to states with winners and losers. In the past, Title I funding had always been distributed on the basis of need, where it was used to support kids who were born in poverty or kids who had educational disabilities or language learning issues, but they were distributed on a categorical basis on the basis of need. Instead, the Obama administration is using this competitive grant process to distribute funds to winners who agree to implement the administration's particular policy reforms, such as increasing the number of charter schools or using test scores to make decisions about teacher compensation or promotion or tenure. And these are the kinds of decisions that actually erode public education, erode the role that teachers and educators have in making decisions, and actually will hurt poor schools who can't write grants, who are in a worse position to actually compete competitively for federal funds. Somebody compared it to having the unemployed duke it out over unemployment benefits. Turning federal funding into competitive grants to support privatized reforms is not the kind of equity and access support that we should be getting from the federal government in this area.
And you write in your article in Rethinking Schools that the Race to the Top has resulted in, I'll quote you here, aggressive intervention for schools with low test scores, including closures, firing of staff, and various forms of state and private takeovers. You just talked about that a little bit, but can you give some examples?
Right. One of the things that happened under No Child Left Behind is that schools were identified as being in various degrees of sanction. And what Race to the Top is doing is actually defining those sanctions in a very targeted way that could have a dramatic impact. President Obama's Secretary of Education Arne Duncan, who was the CEO, as he called himself, of Chicago schools and comes from the kind of corporate business model of reform, was in favor of what he called turnarounds. And what this means is that all the federal money in the stimulus funding, in the new Title I, and if No Child Left Behind gets reauthorized in that act, the administration wants to tie to certain assurances that it will be used for things like closing down schools with low test scores. You might have remembered there was a school in Rhode Island that fired all the teachers at Central Falls High School because it had low test scores. And the president went out of his way to say that this was a courageous act that was right for kids, a model of accountability and typical of what the administration wanted to repeat in thousands of schools over the next few years. Secretary Duncan has been talking about closing down 1,000 schools a year as if he was the CEO of a runaway multinational. But what they don't mention is that the federal mandates under which they close these down require the firing of staff, the firing of principals, the turning over of these schools to private management firms, or turning them over to charters. And in places, especially where there are clusters of these poor schools, it creates real havoc where schools and communities are displaced from current schools, which despite their problems are still important institutions in the community, and often replaced by schools that are serving very different sectors of the population and that are displacing large numbers of students without providing good alternatives. And this kind of disruption, which the federal government has no track record and no resources to really do well, is in fact just opening opportunities for private penetration, private operation, private management of public institutions in a very disruptive way, especially in poor communities.
So overall, big picture, you also compare the public education system in a way to single-payer health care, and you say that President Obama is treating both in similar ways. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, when he was a candidate, he would often say that if he was starting from scratch, he would favor single-payer health care, with government regulating a nonprofit system and providing access to health care for all. But he specifically said the reason he wouldn't press for that in the area of health is because it would be too disruptive to the kind of system we have in place, which was based on employer care, employer-provided care. Yet it was interesting that when it comes to education, a single-payer system is pretty much what public education is. The government is responsible for providing public access to a nonprofit system of schools for all children. The state and the local governments provide the oversight and the funding, and the federal government historically has been responsible for issues of equity and access, you know, school integration, funding for poor schools, things like that. But now in the field of education, instead of sustaining this hard-won public system, which took a long and a painful struggle to build, and to address its many flaws and improve it, instead, Obama and Duncan are proposing policies that are going to dramatically disrupt the system we have and introduce some of the same profiteering and inequities of the current healthcare system into education. And so it's very striking to see the difference in the two areas.
So what do you see as the answer to current school funding woes? What should we be doing?
Well, the federal government first, if it's going to, you know, in this climate have federal funding increase, it has to tie federal funding to a more equitable distribution of it in the states. It has to leverage the federal funds, which because of the budget crisis are more important than ever. It has to use that leverage to encourage states and reward states for improving the equity and adequacy of their own state finance systems. It also has to stop promoting privatization and merit pay and things which really erode the ability of teachers to make educational decisions. So there's a real chance to have a change in federal direction and the direction of federal policy, but it's going to take a huge push from the bottom in order to change the direction that we're now going in.
Stan Karp is an editor at Rethinking Schools magazine. Stan, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Making Contact producer Andrew Stelzer spoke with an editor at the magazine Rethinking Schools. Thank you. The University of California is known around the world as one of the most successful models of publicly funded higher education. In 1960, UC President Clark Kerr spearheaded the groundbreaking California Master Plan for Higher Education, seeking to make quality education accessible to all.
Universities being called upon to educate previously unimagined numbers of students, to respond to the expanding claims of national service.
Yet some 50 years later, some say the foundation of public education is being dismantled through fee hikes, layoffs, and corporate funding. Making Contact's Pauline Bartoloni has more about folks who are opposing the corporate takeover of what was meant to be a public good.
When the massive 32% UC education fee increase was posed during summer break 2009, the fall semester started off with a bang. All 10 UC campuses staged a walkout. At Berkeley, thousands rallied on the campus's main sprawl plaza, spilling into the streets. And that was just the inaugural event. Students organized in preparation for the November Board of Regents meeting, when they'd be voting on the fees. Sociology PhD candidate Zachary Levinson was one of them.
God, I feel like I've never been in that many meetings in my life. It was hard to keep up academically. I barely slept, but it was fantastic. I mean, I'd never seen anything like this on an American campus.
For the 3 days the board planned to meet to approve the fee hikes, students and faculty planned another walkout in protest. But this time, the turnout was lower than they had hoped.
On September 24th, we had 5,000 people come out. So we were pretty anxious to see what the turnout was going to be. We assumed, of course, it would be larger. It was a huge turnout. It was fantastic. But I can't say that the organizers weren't a bit disappointed. I mean, I don't want to speak for anyone else. I guess myself, I was a bit taken aback to see that after that much effort, 2,000 people come out.
The Board of Regents approved the fee hikes. Students in LA had it out with riot cops, and others occupied a campus building. So Levinson and over 100 people at Berkeley met to talk about their response.
As a body, we decided that escalation was necessary. I mean, overwhelmingly, people supported some form of direct action. So yeah, 43 of us ended up going inside Wheeler and locked the building down and occupied it.
Levinson and dozens of others blocked the doors inside Wheeler with chairs and waited for classes to begin. In a video documenting the occupation, the protesters are shown hanging banners from windows and speaking to people on the outside with bullhorns.
We have a 32% fee increase that we want immediately repealed. But you know what? We want a whole lot more than that. We want public education that is free. We want transparency and we want democracy. We want to democratize the region.
You could say it was a spontaneously organized action. Some folks inside didn't even know each other. They texted and called their friends to get them to come out for support and surround the building. And they did. All in all, they were in Wheeler for less than 24 hours, and none of their demands were met. But to them, it was a success. It meant a new stage in the movement. But these folks weren't just protesting a more expensive education. There was something much larger that the students were fighting for. Levinson, as a PhD candidate, will come out of the fee hikes unscathed. He took the risk at Wheeler on principle.
Education is arguably the most important public good. In addition to, of course, meeting kind of bare necessities and, you know, shelter and food and water and maybe this is a sociologist in me speaking or something, but if you look at any stratification research, I mean, again and again, the most important variable influencing class reproduction is education. And so as soon as you close off public education, or any education for that matter, to a massive segment of the population, namely the working class, elements of the middle class even, and students of color, you shut them out of a certain kind of class reproduction process, where these people are then excluded from a certain type of job, a certain type of white-collar position that I think a prestigious university like any university in the UC system allows you to obtain.
Levinson says he was protesting a trend that is changing the nature of public education in the U.S., a change enabled by the economics of the times.
We basically see the privatization of public education. these individuals high up in the administration have been using this financial crisis, which of course no one's going to deny, no one's going to say this crisis isn't real, but they've been using this crisis to force through an agenda of the privatization of public education. So this has amounted to, you know, mass layoffs, basically austerity measures. People who talk about structural adjustment imposed by the IMF and the World Bank in the 1980s and 90s as something happening over there, you know, something in Africa or Latin America. It's happening here, and we see it in California, and it's not just California. We see it, it's happening in the University of Illinois system, the University of North Carolina system. Talk to people organizing at Georgia State. I mean, the same thing's happening all over the U.S.
Levinson and others say the problem is not just a lack of funding from the state. They're concerned the UC system will use the fee hikes to back construction projects, not instruction. But university officials tell a different story. After the Regents' meeting in November, UC President Mark Udoff is shown in a video surrounded by media. He frames the decision to raise fees as something that they had no choice but to do.
Is there any way to avoid a fee increase for students?
I don't think so. We're down over $1 billion. The state's down another $20 billion. We cut people's pay. We have laid off 2,000 workers. We have shut down libraries, at least we don't do the late hours. We have reduced our supplies, our travel. I'm sorry, I mean, this is a situation where the students' rightful expectations just exceed the resources of the University of California.
Udoff says students from families who make less than $70,000 a year will not be affected by the fee hikes. And he pointed fingers at lawmakers in Sacramento.
You know, the problem is the master plan is sort of in tatters at the moment. I mean, it was a great plan. The students paid basically nothing to attend the university, high-quality education, research university, a big chunk of poor kids, always at least a third. And the plan's still a good plan. It's the execution in Sacramento that's the problem.
But some faculty don't see the problem as just a financial one. Laura Nader has been a professor at UC Berkeley for nearly 50 years. She sees a crisis of priorities.
Well, every time they want to change something in this country, the powers that be call it a crisis. If it's a crisis, it suggests that it's just beginning to happen and they have to do something about it quick. But we have the regents of the university for a purpose. They're supposed to see ahead and take care of the university, but they haven't been doing that.
Crisis mode is useful for government and corporations. Serves as a justification for shifting gears.
Nader's been active in the movement against the fee hikes. She spoke at a teach-in at the UC Berkeley campus about the budget crisis. She says there's been a trend towards privatizing the university for decades.
My husband graduated from this university in 1952. His fees were $28 a semester. And it did increase little by little. But then big changes started to happen in the late 80s, maybe earlier in the 90s. What it means is that you value knowledge on the basis of bottom line. You start to give more money to certain parts of the campus than others. You start to not build a natural history museum, but you build stem cell buildings here on the campus, whereas at UCSF they already have several buildings doing stem cell. You start to repeat why, bottom line. British Petroleum came in with $500 million. They didn't look at the consequences. They didn't look at whether we needed biofuels more than good transportation systems, or they just took it because it was money. They say, this is the bottom line, Laura. What do you mean? $500 million? You're going to turn that down? You're going to look at the consequences, I say. Your people are like dogs in heat. They see the money and they go for it.
Bob Meister is a professor at UC Santa Cruz and served on the University of California System-Wide Committee on Planning and Budget. He says a fee increase is part of a trend in debt-financed education. More debt, he says, will mean fewer people will be able to come out ahead.
What the university is doing now is no longer offering you an opportunity to get a higher education and improve your own life and conditions with no risk. It's asking you to assume a fixed financial risk up front in an economy where the benefits of getting a higher education are very uncertain, but where your willingness to take that risk is going to make you keep on paying for a long part of your life for the choice you make now. President Udoff is trying to suggest that we're merely followers and this is happening everywhere. In fact, you see fee hikes, especially over the past decade and especially under Governor Schwarzenegger, have been much greater than elsewhere. So we're actually leaders in the trend toward privatization. And these tuition hikes are going to make UC fall rapidly relative to a great many other publics.
We will win, but it's going to take a while. I mean, this could take a couple of years. First and foremost, this is a two-front war, and, you know, we could solve the problems in Sacramento, and it wouldn't solve a damn thing. I mean, if UCOP and the Regents are using budget shortfall coming from Sacramento as an excuse to privatize the university, I don't think solving the crisis in Sacramento is going to solve a thing.
Laura Nader says preserving public education requires good leadership, and a healthy democracy needs education that's affordable and accessible.
Is education a public good necessary for an informed people in a democracy, or is it a private good for the elite? This goes back to Jefferson. So it's a fight worth fighting, because I think it has a lot to do with the quality of a democracy. If you have uninformed citizens, you're not going to have a very good democracy. You're going to have a weak democracy. We're trying to spread democracy around the world. You have to be one to spread it. So here we are at a time when the empire part of the United States is being discussed and criticized worldwide. The only good things we have, we're destroying. It's like we're eating ourselves. Why would you destroy the one thing that the world thinks is the greatest thing we've got?
For Making Contact, I'm Pauline Bartolone.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org.